Let's turn in our Bibles to 3 John. 3 John, and we will continue tonight in the littlest letters, and Lord willing, we will complete our study in 3 John. And of course, these littlest letters, 2 and 3 John, the smallest books in the Bible, especially 3 John being the absolute smallest by word, we find that they're very similar, and from that we assume that they were written at the same time frame, and even the content is very similar, with some noteworthy contrast between these two books. Of course, 2 John being written to a lady who is nameless and about a situation that doesn't have any specific names. And here we have 3 John. It is written to a specific individual, the man Gaius, and also talks about some specific individuals by name. 2 John warns the elect lady, warns her about apostates, while 3 John warns of, apostates from without. 3 John warns of schismatics from within. Isn't that what Paul said in Acts chapter 20 when he warned the church in verse 29 and 30? I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock, the wolves from the outside. And then he said, and also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. Threats from within, threats from without, threats from within. Now, in this book of 3 John, in our first message 2 weeks ago, we laid out that there's four men involved in this little tiny epistle. And we considered the first two, the Apostle John, who is the writer of this epistle, the beloved elder, one who is getting up in years. He is the last surviving, remaining living apostle that's during this time. And he's outlived many others. And he's writing to his spiritual child in the faith, Gaius. And we saw, and we commented last time, we saw about how John was committed to discipleship and how he was overcome with joy when he was able to see his spiritual children continue on and walk in truth. And then we looked at the recipient of the letter, the beloved Gaius, who was committed to the ministry. He was committed to helping and showing hospitality to missionaries, to evangelists who were devoted to the spreading of the truth. That meant something to him. And though it seems like, and we have some indication that Gaius was he struggled with difficulties with his health and with his finances. Even with those challenges, it didn't deter him from ministering to others in order to advance the truth. He loved and cared about the truth that much. Tonight, we're going to take the remaining three verses that we haven't looked at, verses 9, 10, 11, and 12. I guess that would be four verses. I can count. 9, 10, 11, 12. Four verses. We'll take these remaining four verses and we'll consider the last two men. One was a dictator and one was devout. And so we'll look tonight at the dictator and the devout. We'll consider these men. It's important for us to understand a little bit about them because we need to make the proper choice in our own lives if we were going to follow. And John makes that point to Gaius as he writes. Let's go ahead and read this letter in its entirety before we get into the message tonight. Verse number 1, the elder unto the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth. For I rejoiced greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in thee, even as thou walkest in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers, which have borne witness of thy charity before the church, whom if thou bring forward on their journey after a godly sort, thou shalt do well, because that for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such, that we might be fellow helpers to the truth. I wrote unto the church, but Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence among them, receiveth us not. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds, which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words. And not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the church. Beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, but he that doeth evil hath not seen God. Demetrius hath a good report of all men and of the truth itself. Yea, and we also bear record, and ye know that our record is true. I had many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee. But I trust I shall shortly see thee, and we shall speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute thee. Greet the friends by name. Father, would you help us tonight as we look into your word? Would you help us to not only understand what your word says, the situation that is laid out in front of us, the examples that are here for us, but I pray that we would take that one step further and you would help us tonight by your Spirit to be able to take what we see, to make application to our hearts, to examine our hearts, to lay ourselves bare before you, that you would be able to communicate the true condition, the true position where we are before you, that you would help us to be able to follow after those that would lead us in the right direction. Guide our study tonight, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. So we see here in 3 John, as we take a look at these remaining two men that are named for us, Diotrephes and Demetrius. And we'll jump in right with number one, two examples to consider. There are two examples here that are put forward for our consideration. And John, in verse number 9, introduces us to a man named Diotrephes. Now, like Gaius, it doesn't appear as though Diotrephes had an official position in the church. It also doesn't appear necessarily that Gaius had an official position in the church, just a faithful man that was there. Diotrephes is another man in the church, and there's some debate over whether or not John is writing about Diotrephes in another church and Gaius is in a separate church. I would rather believe, based on John's writing, and he says, I wrote unto the church, and, you know, we believe in the local church. This is not a universal church, so it seems as though Diotrephes is part of the same church that Gaius is. And it doesn't appear that he has an official position in the church. But boy, it seems like he had an unofficial position in the church. He knew how to make his opinion heard. He knew how to throw his weight around. He knew how to exert influence. And if you wanted something accomplished in the church, if you wanted something to happen, it was obvious who you needed to be on your side. And there are people like this in churches today that, due to their financial status, they wield power and authority in an unofficial capacity in the church. Perhaps it's someone with a dynamic personality that people sort of look to, and they use that quasi authority. Perhaps it's even in some churches, you know, where so many people are related. It's a patriarch or a matriarch of the largest family, and what they say goes. And you know, the pastor might be leading the church, but we all know who says what goes, and that can be the case. And so, I think we're getting a little bit of a picture of this is the kind of a man Diotrephes was. So let's look at a few things about this man and some of the things that he was involved in. And note, first of all, his name. His name, Diotrephes, that name means nourished by Zeus. And of course, Diotrephes would come from a pagan background. Almost all the believers here in these churches in Asia Minor would come from a family who was pagan. They've converted to Christianity. But it's interesting, his name is, the name Diotrephes is not a common name. And this idea of being nourished by Zeus being the king of the gods, in the Greek frame of mind, the king of the gods. And it indicates to us that Diotrephes was probably from a noble family. He was probably from a family of some measure of wealth. He probably had some sort of privileged upbringing. And it's possible, as such, as a wealthy member of the church, that perhaps the church met in his very house. And that was not uncommon back in New Testament times for a church member to give the use of his house for the church to meet. And you say, where do you find that? It's not necessarily there. I'm not saying that the Bible clearly states that, but there's some indications that kind of fit together when you consider the story as a whole. And we'll get to those in just a little bit. So you get the idea that there's a good chance that Diotrephes came from a family of wealth. He came from a family where, you know, what they said really mattered. And it's possible that some of those things have, even though Diotrephes has a claim of conversion, it's possible that many of those things carried over into his life within the church. And you see that in number two, his deeds. What did he do? Verse 10, John says, I'll remember the things which he doeth. This is what he was involved in doing. These were his actions. Look at some of these things. In verse 9, John talks about how Diotrephes receiveth us not. He receiveth us not. And we're introduced in verse 9 to a situation whereby John wrote a letter to this church. We don't know what that letter said. We don't know what topics might have been dealt with in that letter. God did not inspire that letter, and God did not preserve it for us to read. And it would be interesting, I'm sure, if we knew what it said. But suffice it to say, when John sent this letter, when he took some faithful brethren, some faithful friends who would act as a courier, and he said, would you take this to the church? I need this letter to be delivered. Would you take it for me? They took that letter from John. They brought it unto the church, and somehow, some way, Diotrephes threw his weight around and made sure that that letter was not received. It seems as though Gaius, in the context of this letter, it doesn't indicate that Gaius knew about the fact that John had written a letter. This was kind of a new piece of information. You wrote a letter, John? Yeah, I did, but Diotrephes receiveth us not. He would not admit or welcome with hospitality the letter that John wrote and those that brought the letter that John wrote. And this is why I wonder if perhaps the church was not in his home and that the church was in his home and that John had sent it with faithful brethren and companions. Take this letter as you go and the church is meeting in this place and you can take it there. And that's where you can intersect with them. And when they got to the door, Diotrephes said, you know, in that nice sort of way, thanks, but no thanks. Maybe put a good face on it like, oh, this is wonderful. This is great. Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take care of it. Shut the door, drop it in the trash can, something like that. I don't know. You know, it's just my imagination. Something caused this man, Diotrephes, to say, I'm not going to pass this along the way I need to. He receiveth us not. Perhaps he took issue with some of the things that John said. Perhaps he read it and didn't like what it said. Perhaps he took issue with the tone of the letter. He didn't like how it was written. Perhaps he took issue with the topic, what it was about. Perhaps, I mean, John wrote an awful lot, and we're going to see why this is a sticky issue for Diotrephes. He wrote an awful lot about the evidences of salvation and that, you know, if you ain't got no fruit, then there's no life. And so perhaps he didn't like that. He didn't like being challenged in that way. Or perhaps he was just jealous of all the attention and the respect that the Apostle John and the writings that he wrote received from the church. And he'd rather that attention, that honor be given to him and rather to John. And so he was jealous and didn't want to share any of the spotlight. We're not given the reasons why, necessarily. We're just told that he received us not. And actually, we kind of are. We'll get to that in a minute, given a little bit of a window as to why this might have been. But the point was he did not receive this letter from John. Goes on in verse number 10, remembering his deeds. What did he do? Prating against us with malicious words. Well, that's an interesting phrase. Prating against us with malicious words. The idea of prating is idle and baseless, nonsensical accusations. Like out of left field, conspiratorial sort of Just where did you get that from? What sort of facts is that based on? Accusations. And then he puts it together with this idea of malicious words. So it's not just a baseless story. It's not just a harmless tale that he's telling about John and the brethren that John sent. But this is with malicious words or with malice, with intent to harm, evil and wicked words. This is slander is what we're talking about. And so Diotrephes is giving plenty of reasons why he rejected John's letter, why he rejected the brethren. And it was accusations out of left field, just pulling things out of the hat and accusing John and accusing those that were tied with John of things that it's like, what? Where did that come from? This is what he's doing. This is slander. And you know what? It ought not to be a shock in the ministry. If you're involved in doing God's work, if you're involved in serving the Lord, there will be those who will falsely accuse. There will be those who will misread on purpose your motivations. And they will go behind your back and they will sow different tales, different stories. They will exaggerate. They will gossip. They will slander. And there's a reason for that that goes deeper than just the stories that they're telling. And we can get all offended and we can get all upset about that. But, you know, it's just part and parcel to the ministry. There's going to be some attacks and even some attacks from within. So he's prating against John and these men with malicious words. Not only that, he goes on, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren. Interesting that phrase, not content or not satisfied therewith. It's kind of like not receiving was the beginning. And here's all the reasons why, the baseless accusations, the slander. But wait, there's actually more. He continues on the lust that he has for this gossip. Very interesting. The lust for gossip is hardly ever satisfied. You got to keep feeding it and feeding it and feeding it. And that's what we see here. He's continuing to feed this lust for gossip, the lust to tear someone else down so that he can rise above the crowd and take the spotlight, take the position. He's not content therewith. Neither doth he himself receive the brethren. So he's got opinions about which brethren should be received and which ones should not be received. But has he ever lifted a finger to receive anybody? Nope. And isn't it true that often those that have the most to say about ministry and how ministry should be done, the opinionated ones are often the ones not involved in any ministry for themselves? Perhaps it's a good question to ask ourselves, you know, and it happens to all of us when the critical bug bites and you're tempted to tear down the leadership of others, ask yourself, well, what am I doing? How am I involved in the ministry? What am I contributing? I can have my opinions and I can have all the things that I might see that might not be right about what someone else is doing. But am I actually doing anything myself? Not one time he himself lifted a finger to advance the gospel. And isn't that interesting? If it's true, if it is indeed true that Gaius was a man of limited wealth and Diotrephes was a man with great wealth, and you have the man with the limited wealth who's giving to the ministry and the man with lots of wealth doing absolutely nothing but running his mouth. Unfortunately, I wish this was an aberration rather than the norm, but I think it's closer to where we live and reality than maybe we like to admit. So he's not doing anything. He does himself does not receive the brethren. And it goes on. He forbids them that would. He forbiddeth them. The idea of forbidding means he hinders or prevents them. We see Diotrephes had set himself up as some sort of exclusive authority, dictating to everyone about what should and should not happen. exerting his influence and setting himself up as the ultimate authority. And this is interesting because maybe perhaps if the church is in his house, you could see the power that he could wield with a church member. Like, oh, yeah, you received him. Well, you're not. If you do that, you're not welcome at my house. You're not welcome to come through my doors. And the behind the scenes, publicly private or privately public, whatever you want to say. You know, it wasn't nothing to see here. It wasn't going on, but yet everybody knew it was going on. Exerting his influence and setting himself up as this exclusive authority. And he is deciding who should be received and who shouldn't be received. He is deciding which missionaries and evangelists should be supported and which ones should not. And he's the ultimate judge. He's the exclusive authority. But we don't find any indication that he is a pastor of this church. We don't find any indication that he's even a deacon in this church. So there he is taking authority. And you ought to be very, very careful about those that don't acknowledge the authority that they are under. Be very, very careful. Because a good leader is quick to acknowledge that they are the one under authority. You remember that centurion that Jesus talked to? He marveled at the man's faith when the man said, "Oh, you can just say the word because I know I'm under authority and my authority comes from above, ranks higher than me. And I can tell my men to go and do whatever. And I know that you are also under the authority of the Father. And because of that, you're able to do the very..." He understood the authority structure. Diotrephes does not understand biblical authority because he's not acknowledging the authority that he is underneath, that he ought to be submitting to. Because this kind of man does not acknowledge that he's under authority. And you know, every single one of us, no matter what position we are in, we are under authority. Even as a pastor under the authority of God the Father and the head of the New Testament church, the Lord Jesus Christ. And you step outside of that authority and try to assume complete authority, try to wield complete authority, you're going to have to answer for that. It's not a good place to be in. It's actually an intimidating authority to make sure that you distribute and use properly. But Diotrephes, he's forbidding them. He doesn't acknowledge that he's even under authority. And then he goes one step further. He casts them out. The idea here, casteth them out. It doesn't say that he, it's not in the purely past tense, as in it's already done, but he's attempting to do this. Perhaps, you know, he has gone to the point of driving someone away. And that's what it means, casting them out. Pushing them out, driving them away. And here Diotrephes, he's utilizing quasi-church discipline, just without the church part. Because you know what Jesus said, right? We got a problem in the church. What are you supposed to do? You're to tell it to the church. And then when the church confronts the sin and the problem, then, you know, biblical church discipline can take place, and that's important. And that's an important function of a church. But here Diotrephes is carrying out church discipline without the church. He is the one doing it. He is the one saying you should stay and you should go. He's driving them out. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, he officially speaking that these people are somehow excommunicated. But it does kind of indicate that he could make it uncomfortable for you to the point that you were driven out of the church, to the point where you couldn't be there any longer. And perhaps one of the ways he was able to do this was, as a wealthy and influential man, the church met in his house and he could say, "Well, you're not welcome under my roof. Or if you do that, I might have to think about whether or not I would allow you in my home. Just remember who's taking care of things here. Just remember who's paying the bills." Again, I can't prove that necessarily, but it does seem to fit. So those are his deeds. Those are his deeds. But you probably noticed by now that I skipped over something. And that is the description in verse number 9, which really gives us a window now into his character. The motivation behind these deeds. And this is the scary part, because we're going to find that the motivation, rather than being some horrible, detestable, gross sort of way out there sin, his motivation lives within all of us. Something that we have to be careful about. John gives us that description in verse number 9. Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence among them. His character is described as someone who loves to have the preeminence. And the deeds, as horrible as they were, grew out of the character in his heart. And it was the seedbed of his heart that produced the deeds that we see. This phrase, loveth to have the preeminence, it's actually a single Greek word, just one Greek word that's translated that whole phrase, so we don't have necessarily an equivalent word in the English language. But it's one Greek word. It's only used one time in the entire New Testament, right here. This is the only place where it's used. And it means just simply the desire to be first. I want to be first. It is the ambition for distinction, for recognition. It is the desire to be the one who orders others. Not necessarily in a malicious sort of sense, but the idea of being able to pull the strings and move the pieces around and make sure things happen the way he wants it to happen. And John tells us that this love for preeminence was the true motivation of his heart. It was not his stated motivation. His stated motivation was in verse 10, prating against us with malicious words. The stated motivation was, well, let me tell you about the Apostle John. Let me tell you about some things he said. Let me tell you about some things that he's done. Let me tell you about some of the very questionable activities that he's been involved in. That was the stated motivation. The true motivation was, I want everyone to look at me. Sin almost always operates in this way. You go back to the book of Numbers, I think it's chapter number 12, and you have Miriam and Aaron. The Bible tells us what their true motivation was. Their true motivation for the criticism of Moses was because of his wife. But you see, that sounds bad. I don't like the preacher because I don't like his wife. That's easy to dismiss. That's easy to say, I think you're out of bounds there. And so their stated motivation was, has God not spoken by us? And of course, God had spoken by them. He had. He had used them. Miriam, he had used. And we have some of her words that are recorded for us in Scripture. God had used them. Doesn't that sound so wonderful? Except it came out of the motivation of, we don't like her, and we don't like the position, probably, that she pushes us out of. We don't like the fact that she's infringing on our relationship. And that was the true motivation. We heard about that with Judas this morning, didn't we? The stated motivation, oh, we need to give to the poor. Wouldn't it have been better to sell that ointment and give it to the poor? It doesn't sound good, huh? And the real motivation was Judas had the bag. When we get into that criticism, that critical heart, that place where we begin to tear down other people, it might be good if we were to just pull back and say, what is the true motivation of my heart? And you might find that true motivation is something you don't want to tell anybody about. You would be ashamed to tell anyone about. That's the wickedness of our heart, brethren. It's our sin nature, our fallen nature. And what a wealth of evil that can spring out of the pride of life, the pride of the heart. Just think about the things that he was doing against the Apostle John. I mean, John, part of the inner circle. John, the disciple who Jesus loved, John, who saw Christ transfigured on the Mount of Transfiguration, John, who was the only one who stayed with Christ through the crucifixion and was there when he died, when he was buried. John, the one who saw Christ ascended into heaven. John, how could you be critical of John? How could you make up stories about John? Well, there is no authority that pride will not seek to resist. There is no authority that is safe from a prideful heart who wants to rebel. And isn't that so true? Pride in our hearts, a desire for preeminence, a desire to be first, a desire to be in the middle of the spotlight, and perhaps, you know, it exhibits itself in different people, different ways. Perhaps you're someone that doesn't necessarily enjoy the spotlight, but you enjoy your opinions getting around. You enjoy being able to say, this is the way it is and that's not the way it is. This is right and that's not right. There's no authority that pride will not seek to rebel against. There is no, and that's often the excuse, isn't it? Well, if I only, my parents were this way, my husband were this way, if my pastor were this way, if my government was this way, then, you know, I could submit. But they're not. And let me tell you about it. What a horrible, horrible thing. Pride. Pride, this desire for preeminence, it was in the heart of Satan, wasn't it? Lucifer in Isaiah chapter 14, who said, by the way, in his heart. He didn't say it out loud. This wasn't something that he just was open and honest to just say, here's where I'm at. It was in his heart. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also on the mount of congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. If you have any sense at all of what is right, you know you can't say that out loud, which is why it's in the heart. And that fallen sin nature who drives its marching orders from the devil itself, the devil himself. This is what's in us. This is who we are. And it's the devil that says, I want the preeminence. Preeminence is the position of Christ. Colossians 1:18, he is the head of the body, the church, the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. That's the position of Christ. And it's pride that desires to enthrone self and dethrone God. And it is an interesting and an institution in which Christ is to be preeminent. There are people who desire that preeminence for themselves. And we could say there are people, but yet our own hearts desire that preeminence at times. And that's the sin nature that we have to keep in check through the Word of God and through the Spirit of God. This pride, this desire for preeminence, of course, it was part of the original temptation in the Garden of Eden. When Satan told Eve, you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. You can have God's position. You can be preeminent like God. It's the attitude of heart that God hates. It leads the list in Proverbs 6, verse 17, of the things that God hates. It is the attitude of heart, James chapter 4, verse 6, that God resists. He resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. It's part of the lust of our heart. It's the pride of life that John wrote about back in 1 John chapter 2. It's that pride of life that the world system appeals to and causes us to be drawn away of our own lust and enticed into sin. This is the pride of life that's in us. We should not be searching around and thinking, oh, I think so-and-so might be a Diotrephes in our church. Rather, we should be asking, how much of Diotrephes is in me? Because even consider the disciples. We won't take the time to go there, but in Luke chapter 22, and of course this is repeated in many of the Gospels, there they are arguing on the road, who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom? Who is going to have the preeminence? And Jesus has to pull them aside and rebuke them and say, look, This is not about wielding authority. That's what the Gentiles do. Go ahead, read it. Luke 22, verse 24 through 27. That's what the Gentiles do. They wield authority. I'm higher up. I've got a higher rank than you. I can tell you what to do. I can say what goes. That's what the Gentiles do. I'm going to tell you, it's all about ministering to others. It's all about being a servant. That's the kind of leadership that God recommends. That's the kind of leadership that is truly Christ-like. But in our flesh, whenever we choose not to submit to the Spirit of God, we are loving the preeminence. Whenever we choose that, yeah, I know that attitude is not right. I know that statement coming out of my mouth is not right. I know that doing this or doing that isn't quite right, but you know, I'm just going to do it anyway because you got to understand my position. Loves preeminence. God, just scoot over on the throne. Just let me sit here for a few minutes and then you can, I'll let you have it back in a little bit. But for right now, I just got to do this. Loveth to have the preeminence. It's in us. It's in us. And what's troubling is a love of preeminence. What it causes in us. It causes our love to be misdirected. Sure, if you spoke to Diotrephes, he would claim to love and to serve Christ. But he was like the church in Laodicea in Ephesus, who had left their first love. His love was misdirected. Instead of a love for Christ, now he was loving the preeminence, loving being first, loving to be recognized and to have attention. The love of preeminence will misdirect our love. The love of preeminence will attack authority. And of all authorities, the authority of the Apostle John. It's interesting. We can be so infatuated with the faults and failures that we see in authority that we become the very thing that we are critical of. Be careful. Love of preeminence will cause us to be discontent with our present position. It will tell us, well, you deserve a better position. You deserve a greater position because of all these things. You deserve that. So why don't you just take it for yourself? And God says promotion comes not from the east or from the west, but from heaven. Loving the preeminence causes us to reject the truth. Here they come with a letter from the Apostle John. And instead of embracing, oh, this is wonderful truth. Someone who has walked with Christ, I would love to hear his wisdom and his perspective and how it might be helpful to me. Instead, he pushes it away. Love of preeminence will cause us to distance ourselves from truth. And love of preeminence will cause us to discard people. You don't agree with me? My way or the highway, hit the road. Pushing them out of the church. And so love of preeminence causes a person to live a life of conflict. Now, I know that the Bible teaches that we should earnestly contend for the faith, and we should. But if your life is characterized by constant conflict with people, in which the problem is everyone else, and if they would just straighten up, then all of your conflicts would go away. Perhaps it might be a good time to just take a small step back and look in the mirror and say, is it my own heart? Is it my own love for preeminence that everywhere I go, I'm just butting up against whatever people and authorities and whatever is there? Perhaps the Limburger cheese is right underneath my nose and there's something that I need to deal with. Perhaps I have the spirit of a Diotrephes. We also read about Diotrephes, his deeds, his character. We also read about his demise. In verse 10, John is very bold. He says, if I come, I will remember his deeds, which he doeth. I will remember. Now, this is to the point where John is considering a personal trip to deal with this very issue. He says, if I come, when I come, we will deal with this. This is a problem that must be dealt with. This is strong language. This is a bit of a threat. Maybe we could say it's a promise. It's not a threat. It's a promise. It's a promise that he's going to deal with this issue. I rather think that Diotrephes' deeds were rather private. They were privately public. They were the elephant in the room that everyone knew was there, but nobody really talked about publicly. And John says, if I come, I'm going to expose it to the light of day. I'm going to present it to the church. I'm going to remember what he's doing. And that, for someone who's looking for preeminence, is all the demise that you could ever not want to take place, that you could ever avoid. His demise. But it's interesting, as you read, verse 12 almost seems like it's just thrown in there. But if you're understanding the concept, it kind of makes sense. We see something about Demetrius, who is the devout. Demetrius the devout. And in verse 12, he says, Demetrius hath a good report of all men and of the truth itself. Yea, and we also bear record, and you know that our record is true. And at first glance, it almost seems like it doesn't even fit in there, like it was just something he threw in there. But when you read the letter in its context, it's clear what John is doing is he's laying out a contrast. He's saying this is the kind of individual to avoid, and this is the kind of individual that you should look to. Perhaps it was that Demetrius was the man who carried this letter. It seems to make sense that that would be the case, that as John, Demetrius came and delivered that letter, and as Gaius is reading it, perhaps he had not met Demetrius before, or he had not known him all that well. And here John is like, let me tell you about this man. This man is the exact opposite of what I was just talking about. He has a good report. He has, we could call it a triple testimony, a threefold testimony. You know, three witnesses required in the Old Testament. Interesting. Threefold testimony. What was his testimony? He has a good report of all. The idea in verse 12 of having a good report, that word good report means it's a witness. It's that root word for martyr. Like a martyr would give witness to the truth, and then he would give his life as a sealing witness to the truth that he believed. This is what it's talking about. Demetrius was a man who was seen of men. He had been seen. He had been heard. The things that he had done, it was obvious to all that were looking on what kind of man he was. He had a good report of all. Now, I notice it doesn't just limit it to all the brethren or all the church, but it's just all. That's all who know him, both in the church and in the community. This is not just within the church where perhaps someone could pull the wool over someone's eyes. In church, you know, they see each other once or twice a week, but out in the community, those who do business with that person, they understand the truth. Those who are neighbors to that person, they understand a little bit more about who that person is and their character. But Demetrius has a good report of all. He'd been seen and he had been heard. He had a consistent testimony. These are the deeds in which he was doing, unlike and in contrast to the deeds that Diotrephes was involved in. He hath the good report of all. But not only that, he has a good report of the truth. And of course, what is the truth? It is the word of God. You could take the life of Demetrius, his public life that he lived, and he was, as it's recommended and required for people in the ministry, he was blameless. There was nothing there. There were no handles. There was nothing to grab onto if you wanted to accuse him of wrong. That didn't mean there was no sin, but it just wasn't lived out in this public sort of way because he dealt with it from within. He had a good report. And his life, you could take his life and line it up with the Word of God, and there would be some clear correlations. Clear correlations. It's interesting that the name Demetrius, unlike Diotrephes, which was a uncommon name more for the upper class, Demetrius was a common name. In fact, there are some other men in the Bible given that name Demetrius. And there's some conjecture. Maybe it is the same one. Of course, you remember Demetrius in the city of Ephesus, the silversmith who caused all that trouble. And there's some that would say maybe it's the same person. That would be kind of cool if it is, although not really any indication that it is. But it is a common name. And it's very similar to Diotrephes' name. His name means the son of Demeter, which is another false god. But you see that Demetrius, his life was changed. His life was transformed. He had a good report of the truth. And third of all, he had a good report of the Apostle John himself. Yea, and we also do bear record, and all those that were with John, and ye know that our record is true. So this is John and all of those who work with John as well. He's got a good report. Unlike Diotrephes, who has this unofficial position, everyone kind of knows what he's doing, and yeah, it's probably not the best, and yeah, it's probably not right, and so everyone kind of has a sense of what's going on. Demetrius, on the other hand, people know. They know who he is. He has a good testimony. So here are these two examples that we are to consider tonight. And we'll end with verse number 11. Because verse 11 is a call to action. Really, in the entire book of 3 John, it is the only imperative. Now, it's recommended there in verse 8. Hey, keep doing what you're doing. Keep receiving those that you ought to receive, that you can be a fellow helper to the truth. But as far as commands, this is the only command. And it's a good command for us as well. And that leads us to number 2, the choice to follow. The choice to follow. And as you read along, verse 11, there's a very clear change in tone. Verse 10 is, here's all these horrible, horrible things that are going on. Here's how I'm going to deal with it. Here's what Diotrephes is doing. Beloved. Singular personal appeal. Gaius. Please. I'm saying this as a man who loves you. Listen to what I'm saying. Follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, and he that doeth evil has not seen God. First of all, he's told to mark the action. He that doeth evil. He that doeth evil. Mark the underlying sin. Mark what's going on. Don't make excuses for it. Don't back away. Mark it and say, okay, what's going on there is wrong. It's evil. It's not right. Mark the action, and then also mark that which is good. And I think he gives Demetrius as an example that he can mark of something that is good. Mark the action. Mark the underlying behavior. And if it's sin, avoid it. If it's good, follow after it. So mark the action. Number 2, he was to understand the source. And it's very clear in verse 11, the source, he that doeth good is of God. But he that doeth evil hath not seen God. This is a very clear indication that John is saying that Diotrephes is acting the way he's acting. He has the character that he has, and he's allowing that out. He's living that out because he is not of God. He's a lost man who has risen the ranks for whatever reason in the church, playing the part of a believer, but he's lost. And John says to Gaius, understand the source. The source of good is God. The source of evil is someone who does not know God. And as Jesus said, wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them. Conversion produces a new creature. If there is not a new creation, there's no conversion. And this is the subject that John has written an awful lot about, even up to this point. Understand the source. A lost person? In a church? In the early church, there would be someone who was lost? Absolutely. And if it can take place in the first century, it can take place in the 21st century. It can happen. Don't let it shock or surprise you. He that doeth evil hath not seen God. He does not know God. But let's get down to, though, the imperative, the command, and that is choose to imitate. The word follow here literally means to copy or to imitate. There's the Greek word that is the foundation, all right, it's like a mimeograph or a complete copy, a duplicate. As you take that piece of paper and you copy it, you imitate it so that the one that comes out looks an awful lot like the original. And John is saying here, beloved Gaius, I want you to follow something. Follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He starts out and he says, here's some things that you are not to follow, and here's some things that you are to follow. You see, we have to understand that there are two natures within us. And understand that there is a draw to do evil. There's a draw to do good, and I'm glad of that. But they're both there. We have an old man. We have a flesh that can draw us astray. And those that we follow after, those that we imitate, they have the power to appeal and draw out the respective nature. There are those that we can follow that will kind of like speak to our sin nature, and they'll pull that sin nature out of us. They'll cause us to act in that way. And there are others, the positive examples, that will call in to that spirit within us that Christ has made alive when we accepted him, when we got saved, and they'll pull that part out. And depending on who our influences are, depending on who we're following, that will have a large impact on what direction we go. We like to think of ourselves as independent, self-sufficient. In reality, we're all really following or patterning ourselves after or imitating someone. The question is who? You notice he says, he starts with the negative part of that command, follow not. Follow not that which is evil. Now, ask myself, why would John have to tell Gaius not to follow that which is evil? And obviously, by the context, he's referring to the behavior of Diotrephes. Don't follow his behavior. Why? I mean, doesn't it seem kind of obvious that he wouldn't follow that sort of behavior? So why does John warn Gaius about following this behavior? Can I tell you something? It probably appeared to Gaius as if Diotrephes' behavior was working. No, look at him. Look at the influence he has. Look at how he's able to dictate how things are going. Look how he's able to have influence on people. It's working for him. Perhaps I should try it. There's a lot of worldly leadership tactics and worldly leadership memes that we can follow. This will help me to be a good leader. This will help me to influence people. Yeah, but is it biblical? Is it what Jesus says a true leader is? The world says a leader is you stand up for yourself. You promote yourself. You make sure everyone knows your value to the organization. You make sure that, you know, if you have to step on a few people to get up to where you need to, you do that because that's what you got to do to get to the top. And it works. And we say, oh, it works. I wonder if I should follow that. John says, follow not. Follow not that which is evil, but follow that which is good. Even Paul stated three times, follow me as I follow Christ. Follow me as I follow Christ. So tonight, as we think about these two examples and the choice we must make, let's first start with the question of how much of Demetrius is in each of us. The pride of life is a part of our fallen sin nature. It's there. How much of the embellishment of that nature, how much of the allowing that nature to have its way, how much of that are we permitting in our life, in our thoughts, in our speech to ourselves, in our hearts? And instead, are we actively choosing to serve instead of relishing being served, which is something that someone who loves the preeminence is seeking after? And then secondly, we need to ask ourselves the question of who are we following? Who are we imitating? Are we choosing to imitate that which is good? Or are we looking for, hey, what works? And really, to be honest, it's what seems to work. I don't believe it's actually working. It just, to our human eyes, it appears that it is. And we can be tempted to follow after those worldly techniques, worldly leadership patterns. And of course, we're going after it for the greater good, of course, but no, follow after that which is good. I would recommend to you, as a member of our church, that you find, and that's one of the reasons why we ought to be together, all right? So that there can be positive influences. We can say, I'm watching that man's life and he has a good report. He's patterning his life after the scriptures. He's all about following the Lord. He's all about being a witness for Christ. And I'm gonna see what I can learn from that person. I'm gonna imitate that person. Instead of looking around and say, well, if they live that way, then, you know, I can do this. If they dress that way, if they do this sort of thing, then, you know, I'm not quite that bad, so that'll be okay. Follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. What are you following? This was the command from John to Gaius. Be careful who you follow. Because the draw of pride, that draw, it's in all of us. And we need to be very careful. And if we're not, we will wind up following it down the path of a Diotrephes, whose only noteworthiness to us is kind of what a terrible guy he was. How much of Demetrius is in you? What are you following tonight?